You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, local governments around the country are taking legal action against pharmaceutical companies for their alleged role in the opioid epidemic. We'll take a look at the influence of drug makers on healthcare providers. First, a new bill that passed in the House of Representatives could have a profound impact on the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA was passed in 1990 with broad bipartisan support. The goal of the bill was to guarantee that people with disabilities would be free from discrimination and that they'd have access to public and private places as they went about their lives. But H.R. 620, known as the ADA Education and Reform Act, strips out some regulations tied to businesses. Supporters say it helps protect businesses from frivolous lawsuits. Opponents say it takes out incentives for businesses to make their establishments accessible to people with disabilities. Allison Barnes is a professor specializing in disability and elder law for the Marquette University Law School. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with a bit of the history. Can you talk about what the Americans with Disabilities Act did, especially when it comes to these public accommodations?
The ADA passed in 1990, bipartisan. It covers jobs, public programs and services, and public establishments, commercial establishments where goods and services are sold. And that's what we're concerned with today. With the House bill, it has passed the House, and we'll talk about that. The ADA, under the standard for commercial places, is that somebody who sells goods and services has to make those goods available to people with disabilities. But an owner must do this only if it's readily achievable, which is defined as easily accomplishable, and able to be carried out without much difficulty or expense. Now, a variable there that perhaps could be confusing is your financial resources. You're a big organization, you have a lot of resources, then what is readily achievable might differ from something little. Anything special that makes it an undue burden is not required. Okay? So if you're like the mom-and-pop grocery store in an old building, say you have four steps, and they've always been there, but somebody wants to access your store, and they can't do that. So you could put in a ramp, okay? But if that would obstruct part of a doorway for other people or access from the sidewalk, then that's not required. That could be an undue burden. You might instead have a clerk take the goods out to a customer who can't enter your store.
I want to jump in and get to what would change under this house plan. I understand it mainly affects how someone can point out a barrier to a person with disabilities and how they can challenge that and then how the business responds. Can you talk about that?
That is right. That's H.R. 620, and it's titled the ADA Education and Reform Act. And it does a few very benign things, like the Department of Justice is supposed to educate state and local governments about what they have to do to reasonably accommodate people with disabilities so they can access your goods and services. So far, so good. The heart of the matter, though, is that the bill would prohibit civil actions, that is, going to court to get redress, for failure to remove an architectural barrier, unless, and there are two parts to this, the person with a disability has provided the property owner with written notice specific enough to identify the barrier. Okay, fair enough. But then the owners or operators must provide the person with a disability with a written description of the improvements that will be made, or they have to account for the fact that they're not doing what they said they'd do. You can see the problem with this in that the second step is entirely in control of the property owner. there is no provision here to make a change, to cause the property owner to stop discriminating. And even under these circumstances, if a private person brings a lawsuit, sometimes the government will do it for you. But if a private person brings a lawsuit and gets a ruling of discrimination, they can only get an injunction in that the court would say, stop discriminating, fix it. That's all you can get. You don't get money damages if you sue as a private person.
And what supporters say, hey, we have a problem. We have frivolous lawsuits. Lawyers, drive-by lawyers, they say, are just filing lawsuits, trying to get money now. It's not really helping people with disabilities. Is that a problem as you see it?
I have heard of this, and I think it's probably not particularly common, because after all, you don't get money damages. So where's the bucks here?
If this were to go through the Senate, which is not a sure thing, it's just past the House, what would the ultimate impact, as you see it, be on people with disabilities and their ability to participate in public life by going to stores and other public commercial enterprises?
Well, as they say, it can gut the ADA. There might be enough votes in the Senate to make 620 law, but this is really a bill that seeks to delay or endlessly put off the possibility of civil suits and reasonable accommodation, which is the whole point of the ADA, to get access to the goods so people can participate in all aspects of life that are possible.
We've seen people, disability advocates, rally against this in the House. It's still passed there. Do you see a lot of political pushback trying to stop this from happening in the Senate?
It is possible it can't be stopped, but I think a lot of people will view this as, an end run. There was litigation. The Supreme Court tried to narrow who could be a person with a disability. Congress came back and said, that's not what we meant. Put it back. That was 2009. And so with that example under our belt, I hope it wouldn't pass. I really hope it's dead in the water, because I view it as a game, a procedural game. If there's something to be fixed, I don't see that this is the way to do it, is to simply shut down all the lawsuits under the ADA.
Allison, thanks for joining us today.
Delighted.
Allison Barnes is a professor specializing in disability and elder law for the Marquette University Law School. She joined us to talk about H.R. 620, the ADA Education and Reform Act. That bill passed the U.S. House, but would still need to be passed in the Senate. First, the number of deaths linked to opioid drugs has risen steadily in the last 20 years. According to the CDC, 2016 saw 42,000 opioid-related deaths. Many local governments around the country, including 28 counties here in Wisconsin, are taking legal action against pharmaceutical companies. They claim that the marketing, research, and lobbying efforts funded by the industry made it too easy to get prescriptions for their potentially addictive drugs. Dr. Andrew Kolodny is the co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. He's also director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. Dr. Kolodny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the role of the pharmaceutical industry, how has the availability of prescription opioids for patients changed over the last 15 years or so?
Well, starting in the mid-90s, when a campaign was launched to increase opioid prescribing, that was very effective. What we saw was from 1996 to 2011, every year new records were set on opioid prescribing, and as the prescribing went up, rates of addiction and overdose deaths went up right along with the increase in prescribing. Since around 2012, opioid prescribing has started to trend down, but we are still massively overprescribing in the United States. There is no other country on earth that comes close to the U.S. in terms of opioid prescribing.
Can you talk about the role of pharmaceutical companies in promoting the use of opioids more liberally starting in the 90s?
So beginning in the mid-90s with the release of OxyContin, a campaign was launched originally by Purdue Pharma and ultimately by other drug companies with opioids. A campaign was launched to encourage the medical community to prescribe opioids aggressively for common chronic conditions. If you could go back in time, if you could go back to the early 90s, that was a time when doctors understood that opioids are good medicines for treating pain at the end of life, that they're good medicines when used for a couple of days after major surgery or a serious accident, but that these are not good medicines to be used on a daily, long-term basis for problems like low back pain, chronic headache, fibromyalgia. We understood that if you prescribe a highly addictive drug to patients long-term, many patients would become addicted. We understood that patients would quickly become tolerant to the pain-relieving effect. So we knew that these were medicines that needed to be prescribed cautiously. The campaign that was launched to increase prescribing, what it did was to reframe very good reasons for being cautious with opioids as barriers to compassionate pain care. And doctors begin hearing that patients are suffering needlessly because we've been too stingy with these drugs. We begin hearing that addiction occurs rarely in patients, even when taken long-term, and that the compassionate way to treat just about any complaint of pain is with an opioid. And we didn't just hear these messages directly from the drug companies. If we had heard it directly from drug companies alone, we would have been less gullible. We were hearing these messages from pain specialists eminent in the field of pain medicine. We were hearing it from our professional societies. We were hearing it from our hospitals. We were hearing it from our state medical boards. And, you know, the Wisconsin is interesting because in this saga, Wisconsin has both the villains and the heroes. At the University of Wisconsin, there has been this pain and policy study group that beginning in the 90s through the 2000s and recently played a very important role in helping deregulate opioid prescribing on a state level, played a role in changing state medical board policies so that doctors across the country would begin hearing that they will not be sanctioned based on the quantities of pills they're giving out or the doses of opioid that they're prescribing, but they would be sanctioned for under-prescribing opioids. And the University of Wisconsin's Pain and Policy Study Group played a very important role in that effort. Also in Wisconsin, you have one of the heroes in this story, an investigative journalist by the name of John Fauber at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who played a very important role in exposing the many different organizations, including the Wisconsin Pain and Policy Study Group, exposing how they were getting loads of funding from opioid manufacturers and really misleading prescribers and policymakers about the risks and benefits of opioids. And John Fauber's reporting would ultimately lead to a Senate Finance Committee investigation of the relationships between drug companies that make opioids and pain organizations. And his investigative work is now also playing an important role in the courtroom as we see litigation against opioid manufacturers being filed by states and counties across the country.
We're talking to Dr. Andrew Kolodny from Brandeis University, and he's the director of Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing. You use the word villain. I mean, do you think the motivation, as I understand it, for a lot of people was in the medical profession, hey, maybe we are under-treating pain. Maybe it is more compassionate to treat them with these opioids. Maybe they got it wrong with the addiction. I mean, do you think there was malice in those decisions?
I think that many of the educational programs for doctors in which we were taught that the risk of addiction was very low and that these are safe and effective for long-term use, many of these courses were taught by doctors who were not being paid by drug companies, but who had been duped by this campaign, who had really come to believe that opioids are a gift from Mother Nature that should be used much more for people with pain. But I do think that the individuals and organizations leading this campaign would have figured out much earlier that the things that they were saying and teaching and the policies that they were promoting, that they were having a negative impact. They would have figured it out sooner, I think, if it had it not been in their financial interest. So just to give you an example, the Wisconsin Pain and Policy Study Group put out a paper in the 2000s arguing that there had been an increase in prescribing, but that there was no increase in abuse of prescription opioids. And in other words, we can have our cake and eat it too. Doctors can prescribe more, and we're seeing no downsides associated with the increase in prescribing. And we know that there was data available to the authors showing that the increase in prescribing had led to an increase in abuse, and yet they left that data out of their paper. And we certainly know today that as the prescribing went up, rates of addiction and overdose deaths went up along with the increase in prescribing. But it's possible that policymakers would have responded earlier on to the epidemic had it not been for papers like the one put out by the Wisconsin Pain and Policy Study Group.
I want to bring things up to the present day and what we need to do now. A concern out there is, okay, you've got that person, they have some kind of chronic pain condition, they've been taking opioids for months, maybe years, they may be addicted to them. If we just start taking that person and cutting off their opioids without something after, they may have serious consequences. They may seek a gray market or black market alternatives for opioids. What's the right way to start turning things around here?
That's a great question. So it's much easier to avoid getting more people stuck on long-term opioids than it is to deal with the millions of people around the country who've been put on long-term opioids for chronic pain, and many of them are dependent on opioids now and would have a very hard time ever coming off. So I think it's a lot easier to avoid new starts. So I think we need to do a much better job of expanding access to opioid addiction treatment across the country. And for these millions of pain patients, we have to help them come down on their doses if they're on dangerously high doses and their risk of overdose is high. We also have to try and help some of these patients that can come off, try and help them get off of opioids. And for those that can't, we need to make sure they have access to effective addiction treatment.
And briefly, as we wrap up, a lot of people point the finger of blame at the people who are addicted themselves and who are now seeking drugs. Do you think that that's an unfair stigma on them when you see problems from the medical industry and the pharmaceutical industry?
Absolutely, and this isn't new. From the very beginning of the prescription opioid crisis, when the first reports were coming out of Appalachia and New England of overdoses and addiction involving OxyContin, what we began hearing from Purdue Pharma and from the pain organizations they were giving money to, we began hearing that all of these harms, all of the bad stuff related to OxyContin and opioids, that's the drug abusers. That's the subset of our population that just wants to get high off of drugs, but that has nothing to do with doctors taking care of their patients, and that any kind of reduction in prescribing, well, you'd be punishing the pain patients for the bad behavior of the drug abusers. The problem was framed as if we had these two distinct groups and all of the harms were limited to the so-called abusers. And, of course, that's not at all true. Millions of people with pain have become opioid addicted over the past 15, 20 years. Thousands have lost their lives to opioid overdoses. And it's not just that these drugs are highly addictive, they're also ineffective. These are not good treatments for chronic pain. They can make pain worse. But the problem was all framed as if this was an issue of drug abuse rather than millions of people becoming opioid addicted.
Dr. Kolodny, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Andrew Kolodny is the co-director of opioid policy research at Brandeis University's Heller School for Social Policy and Management. He joined us to talk about the role of drug companies in allegedly creating the opioid epidemic. The big South by Southwest Festival kicks off this Friday in Austin, Texas, featuring films, technology, and music. Lots and lots of music. And some Wisconsin bands are performing at the festival this year, a pretty substantial contingent. Acts like Webster X, Juicebox, Field Report, and Trophy Dad are making the trip. This Friday on Central Time, Justin Barney from Radio Milwaukee is back to tell us more about the huge festival and the Wisconsin acts performing there. Here's a sneak preview. We'll give a listen to Dramatic Lovers from Milwaukee. Here they are with Make Believe. Coming up on Central Time, a look at a teacher's strike in West Virginia, possibly another one in Oklahoma, and what it all says about education in the United States. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Now, teachers around West Virginia have been on strike for the last 9 days, causing school closings in every county in the state. Teachers there have been advocating for higher wages and benefits and taking the state to task over widespread teaching vacancies. As of now, it looks like a deal has been reached today that will end that strike. In just a couple minutes, we'll talk to an education policy expert about the strike and wider issues facing teachers and schools around the country. First, Jenny Aaron Steelstats is one of the teachers who's been on strike in West Virginia. She's an autism specialist for Ripley High School there. Jenny Aaron, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for calling.
Why did you and your teacher colleagues decide to go on strike a little over a week ago?
Well, when this first started, some of our main concerns in West Virginia were, number one, the issues with our PEIA, which is our Public Employees Insurance Agency, and that's the health care options that we all have. We were looking at a rise in premiums, and the state was going to offer a raise to offset those premiums. But the closer that we looked at it, we realized that we were actually going to be taking a pay cut after all of those changes rolled out. For the most of us, we were going to be taking a pay cut of around $500 to $1,000. But for some of our colleagues, when they included total family income, we're going to be faced with up to $2,000 to $3,000 pay cuts for that year. So the pay and our insurance were the number one and two reasons that we were looking at a walkout. But there were also some pieces of legislation on the table that would eliminate teacher seniority and also some educational savings accounts that we're looking at providing some of the funds that go to public education, starting to put them more towards charter schools and homeschooling.
And I understand that there has been difficulty in West Virginia finding teachers to teach in schools in some cases, staffing shortages in some places. Is that right?
Yes. We have over 700 teaching vacancies here in West Virginia. It is hard to find fully licensed teachers to teach some of those things. Our biggest deficits seem to be in secondary schools for our mathematics departments and also our special education teachers. I know in my county that goes right with the statewide trend that we have a deficit in special education teachers. It seems to be a revolving door. And also the math department in my county, I know we have trouble finding certified teachers to fill those positions. So oftentimes we're looking at long-term substitutes that don't have a teaching degree, that may have a background in math, that come in for a year, or bringing back retirees to sub long-term until we can find someone to fill that vacancy.
Now, a strike might seem to some people a pretty drastic action. It knocks kids out of school for over a week. People have been critical of this and past teacher strikes for similar reasons. What would you say to someone who said, hey, maybe you've got good reasons, but the strike wasn't the right way to do it?
We've heard a lot of that around our communities and around the state, especially with social media. You know, everyone has a platform to voice their concerns. So we do have some community members that are pretty upset about that, and that's around our state, not just here locally. I think the important thing to remember is that when we try to make our voices heard, we have had many meetings with legislators. Our unions have been at the Capitol. We've had town hall meetings for PEIA for months and months now where we have looked for other solutions. We have begged legislators to please put public employees first and look at our insurance and help us find solutions for dedicated funding sources for PEIA. And overall, those pleas have been ignored for a very long time. So we've had a lot of years in West Virginia where this pay has been stagnant and the issues of PEIA continue to get worse and worse from year to year. So it just came to a point where there had to be some sort of drastic action to bring not only the legislators' attention to the issues, but also to get the information out there to the public that there is a huge issue for West Virginia state employees, not just teachers and service personnel, but everyone who works for the state and takes the state insurance.
And we're hearing today that it looks like legislators there are approving a deal, the governor said earlier. Is that right? And does that mean the strike is effectively over?
Our unions have announced that if the 5% pay in the task force on PEIA went through and that all of this other legislation was off the table for the coming year, that the strike would be over. So it looks like we went from the Senate with the 5%. We passed, I believe, 98-1 votes in the Senate. When it went over to, or I'm sorry, in the House, when it went to the Senate, it was amended to 4%. They accidentally passed a 5% instead of the amended 4. So we had a large fiasco there that's creating a lot of distrust of the process. But as of today, when the committee ended, they suspended some of the rules, and they were willing to go ahead and push this through today. We passed the House and we passed the Senate. It is on its way to the governor. He's announced that he will sign, so it looks like this could be coming to an end.
Jenny Aaron, thanks for taking the time.
No problem. Thank you very much for touching base here with us in West Virginia.
That's Jenny Aaron Steele Statz. She's an autism specialist at Ripley High School in West Virginia, one of many educators there who have been on strike in that state for over a week. And now, while the West Virginia teachers' strike appears to be coming to a close, one could be brewing in Oklahoma. Teachers there are protesting similar issues. They say there's a need for better pay and more support, citing stagnating salaries and demands of the job increasing. These aren't just stories in West Virginia and Oklahoma. States around the country, including Wisconsin, are dealing with long-term issues of school funding, teacher salaries, and changes to collective bargaining. Our next guest is here to talk about how he got to this point and what could change at the legislative level to alleviate some of these issues. Paul Revel is the Francis Keppel Professor of Practice of Educational Policy and Administration at the Harvard University Graduate School of Education. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Well, first, your thoughts on this West Virginia teacher strike, a fairly dramatic, a whole statewide teacher strike. We haven't seen anything like this lately.
No, highly unusual, and particularly coming at a time when the teacher labor movement feels under siege because of the Janus case that's up at the U.S. Supreme Court. So I'm delighted to hear they've arrived at a settlement, which sounds like it'll allow teachers to go back to work. Although, listening closely to your last guest, it seems like there are issues beyond the health care and the raise that are under consideration, such as tackling the or removing the legislation on seniority and educational savings accounts. And I haven't heard any movement on that. So I guess we'll see. We've thought we reached the summit on this before, and it turned out to be a false promise. So let's hope that this goes through.
So West Virginia, Oklahoma may be happening. Are you seeing similar issues in a lot of states? Teachers concerned about stagnating wages, rising insurance costs, loss of collective bargaining power?
Absolutely. The teachers, as I say, feel under siege in many respects. Education has in some ways become an issue that a lot of our top political figures are avoiding. I mean, you don't need to look back any further than the last presidential campaign to see that there was very little mention of education. And there have been such divisive issues in the field, ranging from Common Core to testing to charter schools and things of that nature, that a lot of political leaders, business leaders, presidential candidates have just decided to avoid it. And in that avoidance, in that void that it creates, some difficult things have been happening. And you saw them in West Virginia, where state government was passing in the past couple of years some very hostile legislation on public employee unions generally. And prior to that time, some major tax cuts were happening. In an attempt to attract businesses, many of our states, and I'd look for this in Oklahoma and Kentucky and places like this, with relatively weak labor laws, have weakened those labor laws and at the same time lowered taxes, which then reduces the state budget, which in turn reduces the capacity to provide services to children through education. So the quality of education, which is really the seed corn for the future, goes down. So this is a problem, and what we're seeing in West Virginia is a reaction against it.
I want to give a listen to West Virginia Governor Jim Justice along those lines, talking as he signed the agreement today.
We really may have to move away from the idea that education is some necessary evil that's just got to be funded, and move towards really and truly what we really should be doing is looking at our children, at our teachers, at the education process as an investment that we're going to try to make great. Now, that's all there is to it. And that's what we have done in West Virginia, and the world has seen it.
Would that be a huge change in attitude in a lot of states, the idea that education is an investment in the future?
I'm not sure it's a huge change, Rob, so much as a kind of new emphasis on it. I mean, the whole era of standards-based school reform that began in the 1990s was all about states one by one coming forward, well before the federal government did, to say that our future economy, our future prosperity in this state depends upon the quality of the labor force. And we need a labor force capable of doing more than just sort of standard routine jobs. We need people with high skills, high knowledge, capable of doing 21st century jobs that allow them to support themselves and a family. Because we're up against stiff international competition, workers in other countries that will work for far less, education systems that are as good or better than ours, and the onrush of automation and artificial intelligence. So our workforce, in order to be employed, in order to make our economies prosperous, is going to be needed. We're going to need to educate them to higher levels than ever before. And I think governors have recognized this for a long time. The problem is they've gotten distracted and sort of caved into a number of short run demands to lower taxes, reduce budgets, and cut education spending. And that will only hurt us in the long run. And the governor in West Virginia seems to recognize that now.
We're talking to Paul Revel right now. He's an education professor at Harvard University. He's with us to talk about the West Virginia teachers' strike, the walkouts that could come in Oklahoma, and wider issues facing schools and teachers around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this strike, now apparently winding down in West Virginia? What are your thoughts on the strike there? If you're a teacher, do you think your profession is undervalued? If you're a parent, what changes would you like to see in the education system? And are you seeing in your community difficulty keeping teachers on the job, attracting teachers to work in your district? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the West Virginia teachers' strike, a potential strike in Oklahoma, and wider issues facing schools and education. Paul Revel is with us, professor of educational policy and administration at the Harvard University Graduate School of Education. You can join in at 800-642-1234. 1, 2, 3, 4. What are your thoughts on the role of teachers and the compensation that teachers get these days? If you're in education yourself, what's your perspective? If you've left the teaching profession, call in and tell us why. And what do you think of this idea of teacher strikes statewide, in this case in West Virginia? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. To your calls now, Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
I think a large part of the problem is budgetary promises were made.
Jim's cutting out there. What he was getting to, our producer let me know, is that pensions were overpromised for teachers, he says, and that is part of what led to a budget crunch for schools. Paul, is that part of the problem?
Well, I think there are very high pension demands in a lot of the states, particularly as the teaching force ages and more people move into retirement. So that's clearly been a problem. But that's not the whole problem. There's also a problem with the revenues going down at the state level and the capacity of the state budget to support even normal increases in teacher pay to keep them with the cost of living has diminished in places like West Virginia. And teachers are angry. And it's also costly in terms of, you know, this business of attracting teachers. West Virginia has 55 counties, 55 school systems. I understand half of them border other states. And you can cross the border and make anywhere from $5,000 to $25,000 more for doing the same job. And this means it's difficult to fill vacancies, which means you then get unqualified people teaching in areas like Jenny, the teacher you mentioned the shortages in math. Well, what could be more important for the 21st century skills and knowledge that people need to work in fields like advanced manufacturing than mathematical skills? But we can't attract the teachers in West Virginia if we can't pay a reasonable wage. And this is a challenge for us in teaching generally. How do we attract the best and brightest people in our society to come into teaching? And it's not through a race to the bottom in terms of support for public education.
Thanks for the call. Sorry we lost you there. We'll go next to Bill on the line in Greendale. Bill, hi.
Hi, great discussion. I just wanted to add something I think Mr. Robel had said about the onrush of technology and how, well, first of all, just let me say, it's inspiring. As an educator here in Wisconsin, Racine Wisconsin Education Association, it's just inspiring what's happening in Virginia, and I wish all the luck to them. But secondly, I work with in an alternative school where we are trying to expedite kids graduating, and we use computers a lot. So bottom line is I'm concerned about the screen time, as I understand from studies being made on that, and also concerns of the over-testing, in my view anyway, using computers and other means.
Bill, thanks for the call. Can you talk about technology in the classroom and how that's affecting the job of the teacher, Paul?
Well, I think it's changing the job. I mean, the nature of what children need to learn to know and be able to do in order to be employable in the 21st century, doing jobs which in many cases we as educators today can only dimly perceive what those jobs are going to require, is challenging. Now, obviously, technology suffuses our entire society and is a potent part of children's lives outside of school. And technology can be used in meaningful and helpful, productive ways to both manage education and to improve the quality of instruction. But it all depends on how it's used. It's just a tool. So I don't take a position pro or anti technology. That would be like being pro or anti pencils and paper. It's a tool, and it sort of depends how you use it. And if you have students spending a lot of meaningless screen time just browsing on the internet or simply doing word processing, then maybe that is a waste of time. On the other hand, if you use the internet to connect students to people and knowledge and experiences they wouldn't otherwise have an opportunity to access, then I think you can get great benefit. And furthermore, at the same time, will be delinquent in education if we don't prepare them to be fluent with the kind of technology that suffuses the workplaces of tomorrow. I mean, today's factories, for example, don't look like the Dickens era industrial age factory where people are doing routine assembly line work. They're high technology and they involve computers and all kinds of complex programs and algorithms and things of this nature that students need to be up on. And if you, you know, can become fluent in those skills, you have access to jobs which can provide a good living for somebody and their family.
Thanks for the call, Bill. We're talking to Paul Revel from Harvard University about education in the United States after the West Virginia teacher strike, possibly another one coming in Oklahoma. We'll go back to your calls. Kit is with us in Ian. Kit, hi.
I just want to applaud the teachers of West Virginia for what they've done. I've been a teacher, a retired teacher, after teaching 34 years, and I watch the constant pursuit of the attack on teachers all the way from Reagan era at One Nation Left Behind when we started to tear apart the unions. And it's continued on, One Child Left Behind and then Act 10. I can only say that I wish the teachers of Wisconsin and the public employees would have gone on strike as West Virginia did when Act 10 came through. I think things would have been a lot different, but I think the teachers here in Wisconsin have seen everything erode the way West Virginia has since then.
Kit, thanks for the call. Getting into that labor relation issue, Paul, as if teachers don't have collective bargaining rights, we saw in West Virginia, they didn't have those collective bargaining rights, just went on a wildcat strike, in effect.
Well, yeah, they didn't have the rights at the local level. They had seen their rights as union members erode over the past couple of years. And I think frustration and anger just rose to such a level that, after having pursued a variety of approaches to rectifying the situation at the state level, they felt their only recourse was to walk out. And apparently it worked. So this can't help, as some of your callers have illustrated, but inspire others. And it will clearly inspire other people around the country to respond to what they see is an attack on the working people in education who are teachers. 80% of our school budgets at the local level are spent on personnel, on people. It's a very labor-intensive field. And we have to nurture that talent and grow that talent. And we haven't done a very good job of that historically in the United States. And situations like this demonstrate how, in certain circumstances, our treatment of teachers has gotten even worse in recent years.
We'll leave it there for now, Paul. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, Rob.
We've been talking to Paul Revel. He's the Francis Keppel Professor of Practice of Educational Policy and Administration at the Harvard University Graduate School of Education. He joined us to talk about the state of education in the United States in light of the West Virginia teacher strike and the potential strike in the works, possibly in Oklahoma. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the strike and the future of education. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know what you think.